Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have with us today Carlos Domingo. He is the founder and CEO of Securitize, which is a fantastic digital asset company that has a lot of really interesting developments that we'll talk about. But Carlos also has a strong background across venture capital, as well as a variety of executive roles in technology companies and telecommunications companies. And we'll talk about how that informs his current venture. Carlos, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Lex. Good to talk to you again, and thanks for the invite. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Let's start with some of your foundational experiences. And in particular, you've been exposed to a number of things around technology, around building software, and then fairly early on in your career in starting to build companies and manage companies. Can you talk about those early experiences?
Yeah, I was kind of lucky enough. First, I'm old enough that I started my career during the dot-com times. So at that time, I was based in Japan. I studied at the Tokyo Institute of Technology there. And then, you know, I joined a company very early. I was not the founder, but was one of the first employees. And then we went public in Nasdaq Japan, which existed at that time. And because I was the only foreigner and we had the IPO money, then we bought some companies in the US and they sent me to run one of them. So very early on in my career, where I was not really prepared to do that, but I took a CEO role in a US-based startup software company and had a lot of like much more senior and experienced people reporting to me. And because we were a small startup, you know, it allowed me to, you know, kind of learn a lot of the different parts of the company, right? Because as a CEO of a small company and also me being kind of like young at the time, I was 30 years old, it allowed me to basically get involved in finance, in HR, in operations, in obviously sales, you know, product development, etc. So I think that kind of gave me a bit of a broader, let's say, experience than just the pure technical side of things, which is where I come from. My background is that I have a PhD in computer science, and it kind of informed me from the future to really move into more of my management and executive positions rather than just stay only on pure, you know, technical roles, but always within technology companies.
I think it's a really interesting kind of big bang moment, actually, what you describe. Like your experience with equity and the value that equity can create was so early on in your career that it so quickly propelled you into being an operator. What was the company that went public? What kind of things did it do? And then do you remember any of that process of going public, you know, during the dot-com boom? And like, what were the feelings around it, if you could give us a flavor?
Yeah, so the company was doing, it's kind of funny because it was doing something back then was called digital assets, which has nothing to do with what digital assets are today, right? So at that time, a digital asset was basically a JPEG file. We were doing like fonts, digital fonts, etc. Keep in mind at that time, everything was not digital, right? So managing digital files, like let's say images for graphic designers or fonts that are licensed and etc., was actually a big problem. So there was, you know, digital asset management software actually was called, that was managing these digital assets, which are, as I said, completely different to what today we refer to in the context of crypto as digital assets, right? Which are basically tokens, etc. But it was all about digitization, which was kind of like the theme at that time. You know, software was still being distributed physically. So we used to have like warehouses where we print CDs, print in boxes, and send it to the Apple Store, which just started at that time, etc. So it was a very different world where digitization was the main thing. In terms of going public, you know, what I remember was the excitement, and, you know, Nasdaq in Japan was actually set up by Masayoshi Son, who is, you know, very well known now as the founder of SoftBank, but back then was extremely well known in Japan, probably not well known globally like it is today. So I do remember like the days before the IPO, they did a party in a disco in Roppongi, and he showed up there in a limousine, and it was like a rock star. People were taking pictures of him, etc. So it was a lot of excitement, and at the same time, a lot of responsibility. And then I obviously saw the other side of things of like probably going public too early, and the downsides of that in terms of, you know, financial reporting, and then, you know, the crash of the dot-com, how it impacted a lot of companies, including ours. The Nasdaq Japan actually closed, so the company eventually got delisted. So, yeah, I guess I lived through the ups and downs of public markets very early on in my career.
So that's interesting, too, in the sense that, you know, it's one thing to just always be at a public company and you kind of expect a fairly stable path. And then it's another thing to go from private to public, see the expansion of value and the potential promise of that, and then see the public markets kind of crush the life out of it. And we're in a really similar place today if you look at a lot of things, whether it's, you know, Affirm or Coinbase or Robinhood or a lot of these fintech companies kind of had, you know, really big valuations. Some of them ended up going public, some of them ended up going the SPAC route, and now they're all compressed and crushed, and we're sort of in this recessionary environment. What kind of lessons did you take about those cycles, and in particular about those cycles and the relationship of those cycles to like ownership, to like how people are motivated to build things and like how incentives work and how timing works?
First, I want to frame the difference between what happened back then and what happens today. So today you mentioned Affirm and, you know, Coinbase, Robinhood, etc. First, these companies are very, to some extent, mature companies, right? Like Coinbase has been around for, I don't know, close to a decade at this point in time, or 8 years at least. The same for Affirm, and, you know, companies like Airbnb has been around for, like, I think 14 years before it went public. And their valuations are multi-billion dollar valuations, right? So Coinbase, I think, pre-IPO was like 100 billion, and now it's still like around 20, Robinhood's probably around 10 now. So yes, they are suffering the you know, being public and the reporting and how, you know, they crash because of market sentiment irrespective of whether how the business is doing and stuff like that. But before, at that time in the dot-com times, it was much more extreme because there was like much smaller companies at a much lower valuations and less mature companies that were going public. So I do remember, like, when Amazon went public, I think Amazon was just like a 3-year-old company, and the market cap of Amazon was $300 million, believe it or not. So it was a very different time. Going public was basically the only way for companies to access capital. And then companies went public very, very early on when probably they shouldn't have been public. But I think today the market has significantly shifted. Companies go public much later to access, you know, capital markets, because private capital markets have been growing tremendously and there's a lot of money that they can actually access before going public. I would say maybe with the exception of some of the SPACs, IPOs that have happened in the last couple of years, which I think has been a bit of an anomaly, and it's probably not going to continue at the same pace the next years. So really now is very different, I would say, in terms of going public. I think at that time, companies went public probably too early when they were not ready for being publicly traded companies.
That's a really interesting point in light of what tokens are as well, because one of the complaints that people have about tokens is that they create a publicly floating currency or price for very early stage projects, which can really blow up different incentives and make people behave in strange ways. And so I guess in some ways, the dot-com companies, they were more similar to token exposure in the sense that a lot more retail investors could actually access those early stage investments. Like a $200 million market cap Amazon is very early stage as an opportunity. Whereas now we're in a really funky place where things stay private until they are decacorns. Like companies choose not to access the public capital markets until they're worth $10, $20, $50 billion when they can just come in and cash out. And I think that's really interesting in light of kind of some of the trends of around private equity and digital assets that we'll talk about. Before we get there, maybe can you talk about your experience in the telecom sector and what kinds of things compelled you there, what pulled you in that direction, and we'll go from there.
Before we get that, I just want to make a comment. I agree with you that, you know, the companies that did ICOs or that have tokens that are become liquid too early on, and they raised too much money too early on, which has happened to many companies in the crypto space, especially 2017 and 18. I think that's a very bad thing, because it sets the wrong incentive for the management. It also, you know, there's a lot of zombie companies, I call them, in the crypto space that there should be there if they were like going through a normal like funding cycle, because they would have never been funded for so many years compared to the very little that they have contributed to the industry. But they are still there because they have a token that is liquid that allows them to like generate cash by selling their own treasury periodically, plus they raise probably a huge amount of money for a pre-product market fit company through an ICO, etc. So I think that that's actually a very negative thing in the crypto space. But unfortunately, it's what it is, and we will probably get, you know, clean up over the years. But it take a lot of years for cleaning up a lot of these companies in the space. So then going back to your question about telecommunications. So I went to telecommunications not because I wanted to work for a telecommunications company. It was just like at that time, I'm originally from Spain, and you know, I studied in Japan, and therefore I left Spain before I actually worked ever in Spain, and you know, spent the first, let's say, few years of my career in Japan first, and then in the US on the West Coast. And then I got a call from a headhunter to join, you know, Telefonica, which is at the time I think was the largest company in Spain, and it was a very predominant telecommunications company. And it was an opportunity for me to do two things. One is go back to Spain and work there for a few years, which was nice, and after, you know, a few years abroad. And then the second thing is work for a corporate, which I was kind of curious as well about, you know, moving from a startup where you're always struggling, you always lack of resources, you have to wear like so many different hats, etc. And I felt like, well, trying a large corporation in my career will give me a different type of experience. So what I didn't expect was that, you know, I joined the telecommunications industry literally the year before the iPhone came up, and then Android came up. And that I do remember, like, very early, one of my first meetings just after the iPhone came up at the Google headquarters, where the Google team was showing me how, you know, mobile search have, you know, went completely ballistic because of the iPhone. And that triggered them, like, you know, acquiring Android and releasing Android. And, you know, we know the rest of the telecommunications industry got transformed. And I got to live like probably the most interesting years for telcos, because it was the time that it felt like they could actually be relevant, because digital was finally happening, and you know, it was moving from pure basic communication services like SMS and voice into like data and then value-added services on top of it. So I really enjoy it. I also enjoy it. Like, I know it sounds weird because I'm again at a startup, but I think going through a large corporation a few years in your career is actually something good as well, because it gives you structure and processes and stuff that in startups you're never going to learn, because they're too chaotic. So.
Right. There's nothing like a good Lehman Brothers experience to set you straight for the rest of your life. So I think this framing that you have of Telefonica is quite interesting too, right? Where the platform shift of mobile and kind of the power shift to large internet technology firms, move the industry in this orthogonal way. Like, it really rotated the power between the phone companies and the content producers and technology companies in such a way as to make technology companies the application, the storefront. And what was previously kind of the core consumer surplus ended up becoming like infrastructured and ended up becoming a commodity, although very large scale, but it became plumbing and the value moved into the next layer of applications. And I think we see some of this as an analogy in blockchain and finance too, where, you know, in the past, financial services companies, by their access to funds or private equity or other investment assets, were the core consumer surplus. That's where people would come to. But then with the introduction of blockchains and tokenization, you also are now just starting to see that pivot where things are getting layered on top of finance and then cranked out into a different paradigm that looks a lot more like, at least in my view, Web3, and has the potential to kind of shift that primacy of the product out of the people that used to be storefronts and turn the storefronts into infrastructure. That's quite a thesis to put on you, but I wonder if that resonates and if you see any similarities of that kind.
Yeah, so at the beginning of crypto, you probably remember this whole thesis about the FAT protocols, and that's where the value was going to accrue. And that so far has been the case. I think we're going to see a shift, which is similar, as you described, to what happened in telecommunications industry, where the infrastructure layer will still be monetized, right? The way that, you know, telcos still make money, right? It just will become less and less relevant over time. And then eventually the value will move into the application layer. Because at the end of the day, what people consume is not infrastructure, but applications. And that's something we need to keep in mind. Like, I think crypto has been, and one of the criticisms of crypto is precisely that, you know, there's no use case and nobody's using it. Well, partly is because a lot of the investment and the effort in the community, and today just another layer one that raised $300 million. Like, why do you need so many new layer ones? So, but a lot of the investment and the effort and the creativity has gone into the infrastructure layer and a lot less into the application layer. And I think it's time for the industry to kind of like start shifting the focus, because I think we do have enough infrastructure to start doing a lot of cool stuff, and probably, you know, DeFi and now NFTs, and hopefully the next wave is digital asset securities are the first kind of like use cases that are useful that are outside the pure infrastructure layer, and then value will accrue potentially in a bigger way to these companies that are focusing there.
Let's hop into your investment practice and the work that you've done, you know, at Spice and maybe in part in Techstars. I'd love to learn about like what your investment thesis was and then how it led you towards Securitize.
So first, I've always been curious about investment. I remember during the dot-com times opening an E-Trade account, which was the thing back then, and then being able to trade, you know, publicly traded companies very early on, where there were companies that actually, you know, were very, you know, early stages as we discussed, and small, that you can actually purchase shares in companies that you were using their products. And so I've always been fascinated about that. And then when I moved back to Spain to work for Telefonica, at that time the VC industry was very, very nascent in Spain. And I joined one of the first groups of angel investors and started doing, you know, writing some of my own checks into small startups. And I always enjoy that part. I don't think that I want to do that full time because I'm too much of an operator and I have a tendency to want to do things myself and run things. But I still enjoy it. And you always learn a lot about different industries that, you know, because the entrepreneur running that particular product obviously is very knowledgeable of what they do, which is something I like. It expands my knowledge. And then in the case of, so when I was in Dubai, actually during Techstars for a while, I've always been mentoring a lot of people. I think it's very rewarding because, again, it gives you an opportunity to share your knowledge, but also to learn from other people that are deeper into specific industries than you are. And then the Spice VC was actually the initial investment thesis before I actually joined the project. It had nothing to do with blockchain or crypto, et cetera. It was more about, you know, it was at that time in the market, a bit of a gap between Series A and Series B. Like, it was very easy to get early stage money, but it was very difficult to get to scale so you can actually access the Series B investors. So there was no money at that particular part of the market. So that was the initial investment thesis when I joined the project. My contribution, if you want, at the very beginning was actually the suggestion of why don't we do an ICO for Spice VC, because the people running it at that time, they were like starting to actually raise money from LPs because it was a first time fund. And this was 2017 when the ICO mania was at its peak, and I had been participating myself in many of the early ICOs. And I was fascinated that people could actually raise money with a token from anonymous people, right? So it's kind of like a crowdfunding already existed, but it was kind of like a cooler version of crowdfunding that you could run globally and you can do it in a very different way. So that was kind of the thing. Let's do an ICO for Spice VC. And then the second thing is like, well, we're going to do a tokenized fund, which was that term that would exist at the time, but we're going to do an ICO for a fund. Then why not actually, you know, dedicate the fund to invest in the same industry that we're kind of leveraging this new cool technology to do it, and how Spice VC at its current state was formed. And then kind of like the next thing is, well, how do you do an ICO for a fund? Because a fund is, you know, a regulated entity, right? And then, you know, talking to lawyers obviously became clear to us, in spite of some lawyers actually telling us different, that these are securities and therefore you can't just run an ICO for a fund the way that, let's say, some of the early ICOs were conducted, where people basically were, you know, sending a token, you know, some crypto into a smart contract and receiving tokens back. And there was no, you know, it was open to anybody on the web, you know, no KYC or anything, no tracking of who the investors are, no AML, et cetera. So I think that was kind of like the second thing of, well, this is a regulated. So how do we do what we call at the time a regulated ICO?
I remember around that time looking at Blockchain Capital, which had, I think, tried to do some tokenization as well. And I've never seen more entities in a circular diagram with offshore accounts on a page ever. I mean, the structuring that was required to try and connect a token interest to an actual, you know, investment interest, I think is just wild, the difficulty.
Yeah, so actually that's a kind of interesting thing, because, you know, it leads me to how I actually met the Blockchain Capital guys, which now are my largest investors, Brad Stevens, sitting in our board of directors, and I can probably call them more than just investors friends. You know, when we were like debating this, and we actually talked to Alan and Ori in the UK, because that's where we were going to incorporate SpicePC, ended up being in Singapore later, but we actually, then the security token offering for Blockchain Capital came up. And I do remember reading all these articles at that time, Brock Pierce was with them, and obviously Brock is a very media-oriented person, so he did a lot of like interviews and stuff about how this is the way you conduct ICOs because these are securities and blah, blah, blah. And then I started then, you know, reading how this guy is doing it, right? So and then I remember there was some guy that wrote a blog post saying this is the most lawyer-up ICO ever. Because obviously they had like an information memorandum that had like 100 pages that, you know, I read in detail, trying to understand what's the legal structure. I had no idea about regulations at that time. So, but it was a fantastic experiment and a very pioneer one. And then we come up then with the SpicePC and kind of changed the token structure. There was an open-ended fund. You know, there was no distributions back to token holders. And you could only, you know, they could only buy on the open market some of the tokens to increase the value of the remaining tokens. And it was a very different structure for good reasons back then, for regulatory reasons. And then we come up with a different structure for SpicePC, more like mimicking what a traditional fund is, where, you know, it's a close-ended. As you, some of your investments mature and you exit them, then you distribute money back to your investors and then, you know, redeem some of the tokens so that amount of outstanding tokens gets reduced over time and then eventually goes to zero. The fund doesn't have any more assets that it's holding. And then through, you know, through Brock, actually, I, you know, met Brad Stevens. I was living in Dubai at that time and he was visiting there with his family, and that's how we connected. And then they ended up being, you know, part of the Securitize family later.
What was the initial formulation of Securitize?
When we started the project of tokenized SpicePC, initially there was no Securitize, but then, you know, we hired for, you know, our CTO for SpicePC, usually a fund doesn't have a CTO, but because we need to develop the tokenization platform for SpicePC, we needed technical people. So we hired Shai Finkelstein, who then, you know, came into being one of the founders of Securitize. And then at the time, it was kind of like a realization that, well, you know, the fund's cool and, you know, and it's an impactful project in terms of being the first fully tokenized fund and different than how Blockchain Capital was. And we're going to invest in this new and, you know, industry that's developing, et cetera. But where the value potentially is actually on the tokenization platform to offer it to other people. So the people involved there, like Jamie Finn, then came to found Securitize and other people. And there was a lot of internal debate whether, you know, is this a different thing or this is part of the same thing? And, you know, do we need to separate it or not? Blah, blah, blah. And I was, from the beginning, I was like, yeah, we need to separate it. That the fund has nothing to do. The fund should focus on finding good investments and helping them be successful and return money to shareholders. And the tokenization platform that we kind of stumbled upon in the project is something that should be completely different because it should be managed as a technology company and it should have a different structure and a different mandate and needs to raise money from different people, etc. So it was not clear to everybody at the beginning there, but eventually that's what happened. And we then split the two projects. And today, Talal Yassif is one of the founders of SpicePC, runs the fund, and still obviously more from a investment committee perspective, but then, you know, I moved into Securitize full time as the founder and CEO.
And this was also a moment where ICOs had crashed out, and part of that was the regulatory pushback, fairly so. And what people thought was coming next were security tokens. They thought that first it was Bitcoin, but no, not Bitcoin. Let's go with the blockchain and have big enterprise blockchains inside of banks. And then, you know, the reaction to that is, look at all these ICOs, they're out in the wild, they can do things like let anyone raise money. And then that crashed out, and their conservative reaction to that is, okay, well, let's try security tokens and first create financial instruments and then tokenize them on likely private blockchains. You know, and then the reaction to that was DeFi, and we kind of know how things continued to spin out. But can you talk about that moment of thinking about security tokens, trying to size it, and then kind of aiming the company at what to pursue?
So you're absolutely right. So when the ICO industry kind of crashed in 2018 alongside the entire crypto industry back then, and then also I guess in 2017 there was this SEC report about the DAO basically saying, you know, the DAO, which did an ICO, it's an unregistered sale of securities. And therefore, that most people feel like any other ICO is an unregistered sale of securities. And therefore, the answer to this problem are security tokens, because they're tokens that actually represent securities. And then, at that time in 2018, there were so many companies, including ourselves, including you guys at Consensys. You started Consensys, it was called Digital Securities, if I remember correctly. You know, there were literally, you know, 50 to 70 projects across the world focused on security tokens. And that was 4 years ago. And the main theme was, well, regulators are going to regulate this, and therefore tokens, a lot of the tokens out there will be securities, and therefore whoever is focusing on the space has a business to do. And that actually, 4 years after, has not really happened. We're still, like, you know, hearing from the SEC, yes, some of the tokens are securities, but they haven't done anything to really say, okay, you guys are securities and therefore you need to enforce securities laws. If you want to use blockchain, it's great because it has a lot of other advantages in terms of issuing and managing and distributing securities as opposed to traditional capital markets infrastructure. But, you know, people have continued selling tokens for the most part the last 4 years, and that has kind of hindered, if you want, the growth of the digital asset securities or security token space. And at the same time, the other, you know, aspect of it, which is like, forget about new tokens, but think about like existing, you know, capital markets infrastructure and financial services products, whether it's funds or companies, etc. Why we don't tokenize those? And that also doesn't really happen at scale because of, you know, lack of, you know, regulatory clarity, lack of like necessary licenses to operate, etc. So now I think, though, that if you look at the next 12 to 18 months, these two things that for the last 4 years we've been waiting for happening are actually going to happen, right? I think that it's very unlikely that this lack of regulatory enforcement is going to continue, especially after what happened with the centralized lenders and, you know, with many other projects recently. And second, now we're seeing for the first time that traditional financial services companies and asset managers are really looking at, you know, let's tokenize our assets and put them on the blockchain because it's a better way for, you know, distributing them and managing them, provide liquidity to asset servicing, etc.
So at Consensys, I focused on the fintech products that the company had for a good year and a half before hopping into marketing and then into cryptoeconomics. And I mean, you know this very well. It is a massively complicated thing to do because you're not operating at like the brokerage level of a Coinbase or a Fidelity, and you're not even operating at the capital markets desk level that is putting funds together or putting positions together and trading them. You're going down, down, down into custody, into settlement, into tokenizing. How does the cash come in? And then for all of these things, if you want to play it by the book, you need to have entities that support the underlying activities. So if you're dealing with private equity, or if you're dealing with bonds, or if you're trying to deal with some sort of exchange or be a, you know, a trading system, and then if you're trying to do that on a global basis, the fixed cost of entry, both in terms of capital to be a broker dealer and so on, or to get an ATS, as well as just the mental complexity of being able to do something like this, is absolutely astounding, right? When in comparison, you can have a 13-year-old go and mint a token on Web3 and sell it to 1,000 people within, you know, 5.5 minutes, in the same amount of time that it takes to make a TikTok. And so I'd love to talk to you about that. Like, what did you have to do in terms of the infrastructure side? Like, what licenses, what regulatory bodies did you actually go after and pursue building out in order to accomplish the goal?
That's a very good comment. And in fact, that has been part of why this industry has taken off at a slower pace than, let's say, the unregulated side of the house and the crypto space. I think now it's kind of changing because all the crypto companies are crushing, while this industry has been steadily growing at a, obviously, slower pace, but, you know, growing nevertheless. In our case, so in 2018, which was kind of like the first year of full operations, I spent an awful amount of time in Wall Street. I probably visited all the top 10, you know, banks and many of the large asset managers to just basically pitch them on this technology. At that time, some of them, they didn't even have teams around this, or some of them had some teams, but they were very small. Like, you know, Boma, I remember, were like 2 people only. JPMorgan had a bigger team. You know, Citi was like building a small team, but some of the ones, they had nobody. And then it became very clear, like, you know, these guys are never going to touch this space unless they have comfort that what they're going to do is legal and is regulated. And keep in mind that 2018 was actually a very bad year to talk to anybody about tokens, right? Because the word token became toxic because of all the ICO scams and all that thing. So even if you were telling them, no, these are securities, we just represent them as, you know, in this native digital representation called a token, they many times they will just throw you out of the meeting. They didn't want to hear about it. So we took the decision, okay, we need to become, get licenses to give these people comfort that this works. And then at that time as a company, the only thing we were doing was tokenizing assets, right? Which basically means we had a platform where, you know, we could do investor onboarding and then issue these tokens that represent securities with smart contracts to control compliance and behavior and things like that. So the kind of the natural fit for what we were doing is what capital markets is called a transfer agent. Again, and I actually, you might not believe this, but I had no idea what a transfer agent was when I first heard the term and what it actually does.
What is a transfer agent?
Exactly. So a transfer agent is a regulated entity in the SEC, in the US, regulated by the SEC. It's not something that exists necessarily in all the countries, but that basically is, it's kind of like the company that does the record keeping of, you know, securities for a company, as well as provides asset servicing needs. Like, for instance, if there's a merge or if there's a company going public or if there's, you have to pay a dividend or you have to, I don't know, split some shares and like all that, you know, stuff that is regulated around securities. So that's what a transfer agent is. And I was actually, you know, I actually had an account in a company called ComputerShare, which is, happens to be the largest transfer agent in the world, where I had the shares from my previous company, Telefonica, that I've been earning. And I just didn't actually know that that was called a transfer agent and what was exactly doing it. So, but that was basically what we were doing, right? So we had a platform that was issuing securities, that was issuing, you know, managing the compliance of those securities on the blockchain and in a decentralized way, but nevertheless, doing that we were wanting to pay dividends, we wanted to, you know, do asset servicing for the securities, eventually connect to, you know, trading venues like ATS and provide the settlement functionality for the securities transfers at the ATS, etc. So that's basically what a transfer agent does. So in January 2019, we hired our first general counsel, which actually came from Consensus Digital Securities. And then, you know, I'm like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get registered as a transfer agent. We're going to go to the SEC. I'm going to tell them we're going to be registered as a transfer agent, but we're going to be managing the securities, not in share certificates, physical share certificates, like a lot of transfer agents do, not on a centralized securities depository, like all the transfer agents that work with publicly traded companies do, and not in some outdated software platform or on Excel. We're going to do it on the blockchain. And that blockchain will be our ledger to represent the ownership of the securities and then manage everything around that. So it took us like 6 months and a lot of like back and forth, etc., to eventually be ready to, you know, apply for a registration. And eventually we got it in June 2019. So that was kind of like the first license that we, you know, obtained.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think there was also, at least in our business, there was a confusion that we saw in the market that was very frustrating for getting anything done. And the confusion was that the difference between using blockchain-based software for your technology stack versus tapping into the demand side, the capital available in the Web3 world in order to purchase digital securities. I think that distinction and missing that distinction is a very tough kind of market reality. So I think there are a lot of banks who are trying to bolt on blockchains into their already Frankenstein horrible workflow stack of 10,000 outdated core banking platforms. And they're trying to stick a blockchain in there and kind of replace something in a very expensive way. But at least there's a logic to saying, okay, we're doing this thing, but on a new architecture. I remember a lot of people showing up saying, I want to do a security token, I want to do an offering, an STO offering. But what they were really trying to do isn't like have more efficient lifecycle asset management or anything of that nature. What they were just trying to do is to tap into people with crypto money buying essentially early stage equity exposure in their startup. And that really did not work out because the asset class of like equity crowdfunding is actually, I think, quite different in its performance from the asset class of tokens and kind of early stage crypto projects. I just remember this kind of frustration of like so many of the prospects and people that wanted to tokenize their assets. I mean, in reality, what they were just trying to do is figure out a new way to raise money, but that market was not there.
You're absolutely right. I think that this is one of the first, if you want, mistakes of the industry. People thought that, okay, ICOs have raised billions of dollars. They were, you know, by many metrics, they were successful, right? For many companies, because the companies that should not have raised any money, they actually raised tens of millions and in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars through ICOs. And then people thought, well, you know, this is illegal. Let's make them legal. And the same, you know, pool of money will move here. And then, as you said, the people didn't realize that when you actually, you know, the token is a security, then it obviously represents a real world asset somehow, like what is equity in a company or debt or some revenue share or whatever. And that doesn't necessarily have to go up in price 100x. And then the second thing is that it doesn't have the same, you know, availability for investors, because obviously ICOs were regulated. So they were like retail people from all over the world investing. That the moment you actually use a security token, as you said also earlier in the podcast, especially doing it in a global way, it's very complicated because every country has different, you know, regulations, etc. And then the third thing is that, you know, these things are not going to be, you know, there was no liquidity place for these tokens to trade. But, you know, you did a utility token or whatever you want to call it, an ICO, and then you listed in Binance, and suddenly you had a lot of liquidity there. And that's what attracted the investors there, because they knew they could actually, you know, liquidate the investment after. So that definitely failed. And I think it's what also kind of set back the industry for a few years, because, you know, obviously tried to replicate the ICO success with securities didn't happen. And at the same time, the people that actually had securities that are interesting, that they were looking at really building their, let's say, asset management business or distribution or liquidity in a new rails and new infrastructure, were still not ready to adopt it. And that the second part, the first part, I don't think ever is going to happen. Like, you're never going to convince crypto people that speculate with tokens in regulated exchanges to then invest in securities, because it's a different beast. The other part is, I think, where the interesting things are going to start happening, of asset managers realizing this is just a better way for them to issue, manage, distribute it, and provide liquidity to their securities as kind of like the first step into digitizations.
So let's fast forward to today and where Securitize is. And I think you've got some really cool developments that you're about to announce or you've just announced. Can you give us a flavor of what kinds of partners you now have and what kinds of assets you are tokenizing?
Yeah, so as I just discussed, I think that where the opportunity is not in trying to replicate the ICO in a regulated way. I think that's probably not going to happen. Even we can discuss later about what's going to happen with existing tokens that are going to be deemed to be securities. But that's a different problem. But the other side, where interesting thing happens, is into going into traditional, you know, especially private capital markets that are today, you know, extremely poorly digitized, if there are digitized at all. Right? In some cases, people don't realize they're just still managed in a paper base, and how, you know, blockchain as this, you know, cryptographically secure public distributed ledger that you can then represent ownership of the securities in a very efficient way, as well as like compliance and asset servicing, etc., is a better way for them to manage their securities, especially to be able to reach a bigger amount of a different pool of investors from the traditional institutional ones, and kind of like, if you want, democratize a little bit the asset class, right? So people don't realize that in the US, you know, even if you look only at accredited investors, there is now 13.6 million, which is for the first time in history, more than 10% of the households. And that those guys actually do not have, for the most part, any access to private capital markets at all. So this, you know, tokenization, this asset class could actually democratize access to the asset class. And then I think the asset managers now, for the first time, they actually get it. And so we've been in discussions with many large asset managers, with like most of the large ones in the US. And what we have just recently announced, which is something that I'm personally very proud, because it's been years in the making, is that we have tokenized a fund from a private equity firm called KKR, which is extremely well known and, as you know, tier one and quality of an asset as you can think of, for the first time will be, you know, tokenized on the blockchain and more accessible to a broader pool of investors than how traditionally this asset class has been.
Are there any particular asset managers or private equity firms that stand out to you as being, you know, really interested in this stuff and willing to take risks?
I think if you look at So obviously KKR for us has been great because it's going to drive adoption from other people because everybody in the industry knows who KKR is. And I think it's a very respectful company. But if you look at, you know, where things happen first, which is usually in more like regulated markets, like in Asia, there's been other companies that have actually, you know, been very innovative and pioneer on doing the similar things, but in particular in Singapore. So I think Partners Group is someone that has also already tokenized some of their assets in Southeast Asia, Hamilton Lane as well. Here in the US, Polo has also done some announcements around that. So I think that those are like kind of the ones that if you want to stand out today in terms of early adopters of the technology. And these are like, by the way, some of the largest ones in the world. So, and I think that, you know, once all these projects, you know, not just our project with KKR, but some other projects we have in the pipeline as well as some of these other projects have been done in other either platforms or jurisdictions start like getting bigger, this is going to really, what will be the inflection point for the industry in terms of adoption.
It is, I think, a huge step. Props on the perseverance in this industry and being able to get there. The cycles continue to change what the demand is, but there are, I think, these underlying trends that you and Securitize have picked up on that are permanent and secular. And so I'm really excited for once we actually do get the entire alternative industry on chain and, you know, bridge it to Web3 and let it rip. With that, I'd love to point our audience to some directions on how to find either you or Securitize if they want to learn more. Where should they go?
In the case of Securitize, you can go to securitize.io. And then if you go to our website, if you look at the right top corner, there's a place that says create an ID. It's very easy. Then you do it. We have products that are, you know, tokenized for available for retail customers. We have some other ones for accredited investors, but you can create a Securitize ID. Pass, you know, KYC, which hopefully should be a very frictionless process. And then, you know, register your wallet and then go and play and, you know, send some USDC into your cash account or wire money or ACH, whatever you prefer. And then start like purchasing some of these assets that, you know, so these tokens that are there, which are all like, as I mentioned, you know, securities and are regulated. And we have both primary and secondary offerings there. And in terms of me, I'm Carlos Domingo at Twitter. So if you go to twitter.com/CarlosDomingo, you can find me. I'm trying to be as active as possible on Instagram, the time availability. But I love Twitter. I think that it allows for good interaction and conversation with people. So that's the best place to find me.
Fantastic. So great to have this conversation. Carlos, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
All right. Well, thanks, Alex, for having me.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.